and convert it into stuff that's not archival quality, because that takes a lot of memory.
Yeah.
And then I'll actually, you'll go into my bibliography as we talk about things. It'll be that, and then I can refer to it and get it transcribed if I need to, and all those kinds of things.
That's fine.
So, start off with how you first got to know Vicatia, who was not a governor at that point.
No, he was a state senator, and it was on the opening day of the 1975 legislative session. I had just recently married Frank Roberts, who was also a member of the state Senate, so he and Vic were colleagues in the Senate at that point. And I was working as Frank's legislative assistant, my first time to ever play that role at in the Oregon legislature. And I was seated at Frank's desk on the floor, feeling a little awkward. I was a new bride, sort of, and it was my first day on the job and officially. And Governor, or Senator Attia then, walked up to me, put his hand out, shook my hand, and said, "You must be the bride." And I will never forget it. It was so heartwarming, and it was so open, and it was so clear. And and you know, you hear politicians, you know, and because I was surrounded by a number of politicians at that point in my life, you know, you'd hear these nasty remarks about the Republican or the Democrat that they didn't like. And you know, and here was Vicatia, the head of the Republican Party in the Senate at that time.
All seven of them.
Yeah, all seven, all seven Republicans. And Frank, a longstanding Democrat. And he just walked up to me as warm as if he were my grandfather and said, "Hi, I'm Vicatia, and you must be the bride." So that was my first memory of ever speaking with Vic. I had seen him in the paper. I've heard his name, of course, but this was a new experience, sort of a one-on-one experience with him.
That's great. So in that first, basically 4 years that you know him when he's a senator, did you or your husband have much to do with him? Or, you know, how did that work? I mean, I've heard that teeny tiny caucus described in different ways.
Well, I didn't have much to do with Vic then, other than seeing him around and and knowing where his office was and listening to him on the floor of the Senate when he was carrying bills. Frank was serving on the Revenue Committee at that time, and so Frank had a lot of sort of technical bills that came to the floor as a result of serving on the House, I mean the Senate Revenue Committee, and Vic always paid a lot of attention to revenue bills. It was something he understood as a businessman and a political leader. And so I can remember at least a few times when they would have exchanges on the floor of the Senate, Vic would raise a question about something Frank was carrying, a bill Frank was carrying, and they would, and it was always a very honorable exchange. It was never a cranky or rude. They were both gentlemen. They were both articulate, and the exchanges, as I recall them, were always like that between them on the floor. Sometimes I would notice Vic on the floor, and I'd be sitting on Frank at Frank's floor desk, and I would notice him, and I got so I could recognize his laugh because he had kind of a distinctive laugh, and it wasn't that he was loud; it's just that it was a distinctive laugh, and. It meant he probably told a joke that he screwed up, because he frequently screwed up the punchlines. And
you mentioned that at the service.
Yep, I can always remember his doing that. He had so much fun telling it that it didn't matter, you know. So you would laugh not so much at the joke, but at him telling the joke. And so I can remember that about him on the floor. And he stood a lot on the floor, more than he sat at his desk. I always remember his standing someplace, often at the rear of the chamber, paying attention to the discussion. Not that he was back in the back of the room chatting. He was really paying attention to the speeches and the issues, but he often stood. He frequently was kind of a little statuesque back there, standing and listening attentively to the presentations that were going on. So during that time, I was used to seeing him every day on the floor of the Senate.
Yeah.
So I watched him speak. I watched him ask questions. I watched him interact with Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he clearly knew the legislative process very well.
Yeah.
And for me, there was this interesting thing that I knew because I was married to Frank Roberts. Frank Roberts had been the reading clerk of the House when Vic was very early in his career. Might have even been his first House session. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Vic was elected. 59 was his first session.
So. Yeah, so it might have been about then. And Frank was a reading clerk in the House. I think...
It's a good job for a speech professor.
Yes, it was. Yeah, he could do that very well. And he used to tell me privately, I never heard him tell this joke away in front of anybody else, but he told me privately a couple of times that when Vic was a new member of the House, he was a little more conservative then, and he voted no a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the A in the alphabet, and Frank always called him first because they did it in alphabetical order. And this is long before they voted with voting machines. It was all an oral presentation. So Frank would call on him, and Vic's name would be there, and he'd say, Atia, and Vic would say, nay, or no, whatever, you know. And he did that frequently. And so one day Frank said, went to House Representative Victor Atia, and he said, Representative Atia, could I make a request of you? And Vic said, well, what do you need, Frank? And he said, well, it would help me if you're going to vote aye on a bill, if you'd let me know in advance, because I'm so used to marking no beside your name, and it's the first name on my list, and it messes up my roll call. And he said, so if you're going to vote aye on something, would you mind letting me know in advance? But Frank was known for being able to get through the entire 60 names in the House, just blank, 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 without any mechanism, just check, 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 check. He was very fast, and he was very accurate. But Vic messed him up in those early years when he voted aye. So it was a joke that Frank always told me, and I think he and Vic talked about that a couple of times in the later years when they were working together. But so Frank had this very long association with Governor Atia, then House Member Atia, and then Senator Atia. So. And Frank always talked very respectfully of him, even when he disagreed with him strongly on some occasions. But I think part of my early comfort with Vic Atia was that Frank liked him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that made a difference in how he made me feel because I was learning to know who all these members were that I didn't know, and some of the Democrats I knew, but maybe one or two of the Republicans, but in that small little caucus, I didn't know very many of them because a lot of them were from southern and eastern Oregon, and I didn't know them.
Yeah.
And so I had to kind of watch and learn. So
So
by the time I was in the House, of course, Senator Atia had become Governor Atia.
Yeah.
So I watched that transition as well in his history.
So what was that transition like? Did he hit the ground running? Was he, slow and trying to figure out what Straub had done and what he needed to continue? Or what was it like from the outside?
From the outside, he appeared, Governor Atia appeared to be very, I think I'd almost use the word methodical.
Mm-hmm.
He took things a step at a time and examined them, and you didn't get many quick reactions or quick decisions. He would weigh and balance and check and see where everything was and what the details were. So he wasn't one of those guys who had a press conference every third day. he was very open with the press and met with them just casually all the time. Yeah. I mean, it seems like I'd
seen him. A weekly open door for them, or he'd go down to the press room every week. Yeah.
And I remember seeing him in the coffee shop in the Capitol when he was governor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always exciting to see the governor walk into mm-hmm. the coffee shop. But Governor Tia did that. Mm-hmm. And there'd be press people there, and he'd stop and talk to them. And but it was very exciting for me as a, even though I'd known him in the Senate, it was very exciting for me as a freshman member of the House
mm-hmm.
to have him walk into the coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
That was surprising to me. And I think oftentimes we think of governors getting kind of entrenched behind the closed door, and here he was very open about, I mean, he walked through the building with the comfort of a man who had lived in the House for a long time.
Yeah.
He knew the building, he knew the people, he knew the process, he knew everything. He'd been there long enough that he really had the, so there was a great comfort in the way he strolled through
mm-hmm.
the house, the mm-hmm. building. And the Capitol was like home for him, I think. And you could see that in the way he... So I think part of the thing that became very apparent for me as I watched him early on was how accessible he was,
mm-hmm.
how open he was to conversations with strangers, with little kids, with Girl Scout troops and Boy Scout troops. I mean, he was always there.
Yeah.
And that's the way I thought of him back then, was that he that's exactly... the way he always presented himself was that he was at home.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
was at home in the state capitol, and he seemed to be very at home in the governor's office.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was the image I always have of Vic. And, I remember there were some really hard times. I mean, the economy was so bad, and the
mm-hmm.
tax situation was such a mess then, and when I was a freshman in the House, well, all through my House service, I served on the Revenue Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So I always had a relationship with Vic's office, because if you were on the Revenue Committee in an economic crisis, you better know where the governor was, and you better know which bills were the governor's, and you better understand them.
Yeah.
And so... I liked the Revenue Committee. I hadn't planned to like it, but I liked it. I liked it a lot,
uh-huh.
And I served with some really good people in both parties. But Governor Tia's people would be down there presenting his latest one-time-only bill or his new tax plan or some new nuance of, mm-hmm. of taxation, because they were critical, because we couldn't, I mean, we kept going back into special session and back into special session. I think, if my recollection is correct, that at that time he called more special sessions than any governor in history. I think that's accurate.
Yeah, I think so too. It might have been broken by the five in 2002, because he had a special session in 80. And then there were the multiple special sessions from 81 on.
Yeah.
So I think you put them all together and he's got the record.
Yeah, I would think so.
And they were, I mean, he called one special session was in September of the 1982 election.
I remember that.
It's like talking to Jerry Thompson and Denny Miles, because Denny was the campaign manager. You know, boy, Jerry hated to make that call, but we had to have a special session.
Yeah.
And poof.
Yeah. Well, it did make people work fast.
It did.
At the end of 82, when I became majority leader, so I had the mm-hmm. Democratic caucus was sort of my responsibility to some mm-hmm. degree, and so you can imagine all these special sessions, all this tax stuff. I mean, it was not a fun time to be a caucus leader, because.
Yeah.
Particularly when the governor was one party and my caucus was the opposite party. So there was a lot of conflicts, and the trick was to make the members of the Democratic caucus be more than aware that this wasn't a political battle. This wasn't a partisan battle. This was a battle to save Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's the way I approached it. And I think we had a really good committee. The Democrats and Republicans worked pretty well together
mm-hmm.
through that period of time. But I think part of the reason they did was because of Governor Tia's approach.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't beat anybody over the head, and he didn't say bad things about the Democrats, and he basically said, this is our job, and we got to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that approach was probably critical to getting through that period of time. If he'd have been as aggressive as some of the governors you see across the country right now, just beating people up and pounding them to the ground and, you know, slashing and things that were unrelated to the economy, just political scenes. And I don't remember Governor Attia ever doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember ever playing that kind of mean politics.
Mm-hmm.
He just was too much of a gentleman,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it always made me smile. Another thing I always think about him in those, not so much when he was governor, but still when he was a senator.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, Dolores Attia would come into the Capitol when he was senator. And she'd be coming there to meet him or have lunch with some of the Senate wives or whatever she was doing, and Republican wives mostly. But but she would come in, and he would kind of light up, oh, there's Dolores. You know, it was always this thing you saw in him that that made that relationship so clear, because he would just kind of, there she is, Miss America, you know.
Yeah.
So that I think about that more. You know, I mean, Dolores Attia, like Pat Straub and Antoinette Hatfield, were the governor's wives. They were never first ladies. I never remember any of them being called first lady.
Yeah.
We just didn't use that term in Oregon. They did in other states.
Yeah.
But in Oregon, I don't remember them calling them a first lady. They were the governor's wife.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, they behaved like the governor's wife. Mm-hmm. They didn't have some magic status as a first lady.
Yeah.
And maybe that doesn't make any difference. Maybe it's just verbal. But it seemed to make a difference back then. And when people talk to me now about first lady status and how it works, I say, you know, I don't remember us having first ladies back then.
Mm-hmm.
We had governor's wives,
and
they were all wives because there were no women.
Yeah.
but I think that's an interesting nuance change. I'm not sure when it. I'm not absolutely certain when it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know, but I'm not sure. And it's interesting to not. I think it was with Sharon Kitzhaber.
I think so too, just given her personality and the way that marriage kind of was bookended by coming into office and going out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I would bet as well.
Yeah, that would be my supposition, that that's when it started. So we had a lot of Republican governors back then, and we did, excuse me, and this sounds awful, but I swallowed a lot of blood when I hurt my mouth last night, so my throat is sore. But I think there was a difference in how those governor's wives were treated. They were treated certainly with a lot of respect, and it was always exciting to see them. But they were the governor's wife.
Yeah,
that was it. I mean, Pat Straub had that column in the Salem paper about growing herbs and organically before we ever used that term. But she would write, I think it maybe was a weekly column that she wrote, but as first lady, but it didn't say that.
Yeah.
It was said by Pat Straub.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody ever thought of her in that way. I mean, I don't remember that being different with Dolores. She was Victor Attia's wife. She was the governor's wife.
Yeah.
But I do remember how he sparkled when she walked
in.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it was a really interesting. Of course, as a fairly new bride originally, I would watch these older romantic couples. You know, I would watch the ones that clearly had very strong relationships, and you could see them like that. And so I was maybe unduly aware as a new bride.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So. I know in your biography you talk about particular bills that Victor vetoed.
Mm-hmm.
And did that happen before you became majority leader or after you were majority leader?
Are we talking about the audit bill?
Well, no, the audit bill is when you're, Secretary of State.
Right.
This is the one where there's going to be, like, health coverage for...
Oh, yes.
I
think it was my first session. I'm not certain.
Okay.
But I think it was my freshman session. It was an alcohol bill.
Yeah. And then, but eventually it would just cover, like, a state experiment, but even that got vetoed.
Yeah. And it was intended to say that if somebody was an alcoholic, was mm-hmm. an addict, that they could, if their insurance policy covered hospital insurance for alcoholism, for treatment, if it already covered that, it had to cover outpatient treatment mm-hmm. as well. It mm-hmm. didn't add any new coverage, in a sense, to the policy,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't make any policy have that. It was pretty limited, mm-hmm. except I was... really concerned. I was doing a lot of women's work over those years of women's rights work, you mm-hmm. know, and I found these young mothers who had issues with alcohol, but they couldn't, even if their insurance policy covered to go into a hospital, they couldn't be gone for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
They had little children. And so and people who were average income workers mm-hmm. couldn't check into a hospital for several right. weeks. Maybe a rich businessman could, and that was my philosophy.
Yeah.
It was so class oriented. Mm-hmm. It said rich people can do this, poor people don't get coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And the big argument was that besides the cost that people didn't want to pay for, the other big issue was I lost my train of thought. Oh, that outpatient care didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Outpatient alcohol did not work.
Mm-hmm.
And there we were with several long-term members of the legislature, including ones that Vic Atiyah served with in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
who had gone through outpatient alcohol treatment many years before and were still sober.
Yeah.
And I knew it worked. I had experienced it with family members, and it was very upsetting, you know, and I was surprised that Vic vetoed it. I mm-hmm. would have thought he would have thought it was a good idea for families.
Yeah.
You know, because you want people to get off an addictive behavior and move
mm-hmm.
on. And
mm-hmm.
so it was very upsetting for me.
Did you have any hint that he would veto it?
No. It was before the governor was required to
put the list.
Yeah. To say these are the bills I'm considering.
Yeah.
That was a Frank Roberts amendment, by
mm-hmm.
the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then later when I was governor, I didn't like it so much.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was a brilliant idea when he first did it.
Uh-huh.
But no, I didn't have any idea that it was
mm-hmm.
going to get vetoed. And then when we tried to redesign it in a way that just made it experimental, then we still lost it. So
yeah.
It was upsetting to me. And a number of years later, my sister went through outpatient alcohol
mm-hmm.
treatment. And it was insured. It was
mm-hmm.
a little later period of time, and I always thought about that, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I think later in his career, Governor Atiyah might not have vetoed that bill. I always thought that,
mm-hmm.
but I think he was getting some push from maybe the hospitals.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the business community,
yeah.
But anyway. Yeah, it was very disappointing for
yeah.
me. Yeah, that was...
The reason I ask is when I was talking with Hardy Myers, after he was Speaker, he went back to be Chair of the Judiciary Committee because he wanted to keep the judicial reform stuff going. And he had several things that came out of there that were vetoed out of the blue as well.
Yeah.
And to this day, he doesn't understand why. And there was no hint, you know, no testimony, no nothing. So
No. We didn't get much testimony against the bill once people... They tried the issue of it doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
it's not successful, and then we had all these long-term sober people coming
mm-hmm.
saying 72 years ago, well, it wasn't quite
yeah.
that bad, but, you know,
yeah.
22 years ago I came and went through this program, and I've never had a drink since, and we had people coming before the committee. It was so clear that the people who were carrying that argument kind of went away.
Yeah.
So it did not get the kind of negative you might have thought it did. And I'd carried it. I'd worked on it. I didn't introduce it, but I worked on it. Mm-hmm. And I was obviously an advocate for it, and mm-hmm. never a word.
Yeah.
Never a word. So it was upsetting.
Uh-huh.
But he wasn't the only governor who did never a word.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Bob Straub vetoed one of Frank's bills, and they were long-term friends mm-hmm. without ever telling him he was going to do it. I think it was a juvenile rights bill of some mm-hmm. kind, and he, without ever telling Frank, he vetoed it. That's where that mm-hmm. other legislation of Frank's came from, that mm-hmm. governors had to announce they were considering.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Because he's been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anything else while you're majority leader jump out? I mean, the economy is getting better.
Yes.
At
yes,
that point.
Yes.
Go back. Actually, this once again from Hardy Myers. In 82, when you had the special session in January that was the longest special session ever,
mm-hmm.
and then there were several others afterwards that tended to be 8 hours or 12 hours.
Yeah.
Hardy was saying that unlike previous special sessions and working with the governor's office, they had no hint about what the budget proposal was until it hit the floor. Do you remember, what was your impression of that? Because then it was very different from what had come before, and also then what came after, which were very well set up and negotiated. And
yeah. Well, because I was on the Revenue Committee,
mm-hmm.
my recollection in thinking back on that was we did get a few what we called surprise bills,
mm-hmm.
where we, until they were introduced, we didn't know the content of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have probably been in that 82...
That January to February.
Yeah. Because it wasn't something we had a press conference and say, here's what I'm going to do, and I'm laying out these, and these are the things I'm going to ask. The bill was presented, and, I mean, it was drafted, and it was presented to the introduced, and that was... So on the Revenue Committee, we had no idea what was coming until
mm-hmm.
it came.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, that was a little hard for the revenue staff,
mm-hmm.
you know, because legislative revenue did all those analysis of those kind
yeah.
of bills. So usually when you got a bill in the Revenue Committee, you already had a legislative revenue analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have it right in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We had it soon, but I remember there was a question about whether we ought to even look at the bill till the legislative revenue office had given us some analysis.
Yeah.
You know, and because it makes you kind of flounder when you try to deal with a bill without any professional analysis. And that was very unusual. I mean, you just didn't get a bill that the revenue staff hadn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
And even though legislative... the bill was drafted, I think, in legislative council,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean legislative revenue saw it, because
right.
they can't do that.
Yeah.
So as members of that committee, and it didn't appear to me, as I think back, and boy, this has been a long time,
mm-hmm.
but as I think back, I don't remember the Republican members of that revenue committee having any more information than we did.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he'd, you know, talk to the Republican members of the, you
yeah.
know, because John Schoon and Nancy Riles and the guy from Roseburg, can't say his name right now. Yeah, I lost it. I can't
mm-hmm.
say it. George is his first name, but I can't
I was talking with Phil Kiesling this morning, and by the time we were done, he had 7 blue books up on his table.
Oh, go ahead.
that one, yeah.
Yeah. That, well, I know who this guy is. He was he had a county office before he came to the legislature that was, he was like the tax guy for that county.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't think what that position was called. And he did that before he came to the legislature. So he had the view of a man
yeah.
who'd been handling taxes a lot.
Yeah.
So he was pretty skilled.
Yeah.
And John Schoon, who was a banker, was mm-hmm. a Republican member, and he was a quiet member, but he was a very skilled member. And Nancy Riles was on the committee, and she had been a school board member for a long time, so she all the school tax stuff yeah. she knew very well.
Yeah.
And so we had really skilled members on mm-hmm. the committee on the Republican side as well. And but I don't think any of them were aware yeah. of these packages in advance. Yeah. Didn't seem to be.
Okay, that's good. It's more stuff for me to grill Jerry Thompson on.
Okay.
So, 84, you decide to run for Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Did Vic play any role in endorsing or being involved in that?
He endorsed...
he always endorses a Republican.
Yeah,
he didn't
yeah.
do anything.
I don't think he did. He uh-huh. endorsed Donna Zajon, but I don't remember ever seeing... I'm just, in looking back, I can't mm-hmm. remember ever thinking that he was active in her campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Norma Paulus was helping her,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that. But I don't remember any sign other than just an endorsement that Vic
mm-hmm.
Was doing anything behind the scenes or publicly in that race.
Yeah.
And I had gone through also a tough primary with Jim Gardner.
Yeah.
Didn't turn out to be so tough when it was done, but it looked tough when we started. And I don't remember any indication that Vic was ever, you know, sometimes even in a race that's not your own party,
oh, yeah.
you'll be kind of on the edges of it, and I don't ever remember that. And did Vic serve with Jim Gardner? I'm trying to remember.
That I don't know.
No, it might have been after Vic left that mm-hmm. Jim Gardner came. Because he only, I think, served that one term in the Senate, I mm-hmm. think. So,
yeah. So another, would have been out by 6 years.
Oh, another new booze.
Oh, there. All sorts of
I found one right here this morning.
Oh, my.
So, they're all over, I think. Yeah, God, how embarrassing. Klutzy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's really, as a member of the Revenue Committee at that time, with Governor Tia being there and the economy being such a mess and mm-hmm. everything was just, it was hard. It was a,
mm-hmm.
I loved the committee, but it was a really hard time to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were considering a sales tax
mm-hmm.
at one of the times, very seriously, designing it, dealing with the agricultural exemptions and doing all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are tough designs, and you know, everybody wants out, everybody wants in, whatever mm-hmm. it is, and then we had Wally Priestley on the committee
mm-hmm.
who hated the sales tax beyond belief, just hated it, and made it very difficult to work on the individual issues of design
mm-hmm.
and so and everybody, I mean, it was really funny because it used to be Democrats hated the sales tax and the Republicans pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
Then later, the Democrats were pushing it, and the Republicans were opposed to it. It was
yeah.
all pretty political, I guess, maybe just partisan. But you'd think, you know, we thought, well, now finally we got some Democrats coming over here. And,
mm-hmm.
and I started out as an opponent of the sales tax and became an advocate. So, I mean, the governor must have been watching this with a great deal of interest. Is in the Revenue Committee. I mean, it was the most popular committee in the building for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Every morning, 8 o'clock, that room was packed.
Yeah,
it was packed because everybody had, you know, everybody had an iron in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was just nobody who wasn't impacted by it.
Yeah,
and so it was, but it was an interesting time to be working in the governor's office. I'm sure was. Probably had those on their TV watching
mm-hmm.
the hearings every morning because mm-hmm. it was pretty interesting work, and I'm sure the governor's office was paying close attention to it.
Yeah.
I don't remember they're ever intruding in the debates and discussions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't remember seeing someone from the governor's office down there saying, we can't accept that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just let us design it, knowing it wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
It would go over to the Senate and the Ed Fadley would make sure it didn't go anywhere.
Exactly. Well, you were talking about the Republicans and Democrats on the sales tax. When I was talking to Wally Carson, he at one point went up to visit a counterpart in Washington, at the Washington legislature. He said he never knew the power of the Columbia River, but Republicans on this side felt one way about sales tax, and Republicans on the other side felt exactly the opposite. Hardcore reasons. He just never knew the river was that powerful.
Well, I remember a state representative from Vancouver who was pushing for an income tax in Washington State while I was over here pushing for a sales tax. And he said, we were both in the House, and he said, you know, Barbara, if we keep working on these two issues the way we are, pretty soon you and I are going to have a lot of time for lunch because we're neither one going to get reelected. And that's true. That river was just... they hated the income tax as bad as Oregonians hated the sales tax. So it was pretty funny.
Looking at the Revenue Committee and its work, and then we'll move to Secretary of State. Was it the definitive committee? When things came out of there, did they change much when they went to other committees and then made it to the floor, or was that really it?
They usually went directly to the floor.
Directly to the floor.
They just went from Revenue Committee to Revenue Committee to the floor. Those bills very seldom had any subsequent referrals on them.
So that's the definitive word is right there.
And because they really didn't have, they didn't belong anyplace else.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could have sent a sales tax to the Agriculture Committee because it affected agricultural exceptions and that kind of thing, or timber exceptions. So I suppose you could have done that, but I don't recall that very often. And because I sat on the Revenue Committee and chaired the caucus, the Democratic caucus, my job was if we wanted those, and these were Democratic committees, and the House committee was a Democratic committee. So once it got out of that committee, then my caucus had, in the Democratic caucus, we never took an official stand on a bill and said every member of the caucus will vote this way or that. We never did that. There was pressure. There was encouragement. There was push. But nobody was ever told that they had to vote one way or another on a bill. It was pretty strong Democratic caucus philosophy that you couldn't do that, that they were their own vote.
Were there, because I know there were, that's still in the days when there were conservative Democrats. They're beginning to disappear at that point. But were you as the majority leader reaching out at all to the moderate Republicans, or were they just kind of, you knew they'd come along, or how did that work?
I did not reach out to Republican members as a caucus leader. There were, you know, we had, like I said, John Schoon and George, what's his name? I mean, starts with a T. And Nancy, and you know, so we had good Republicans that we thought could make this message in their own caucus, and oftentimes they voted on the same side with us. A lot of times those bills came out without, except for Wally Priestley, with basically pretty strong votes. We got it. My recollection is we got a lot of those tax bills out with pretty bipartisan votes in a lot of cases. Not always, but sometimes. And my job was to make sure that my people in my caucus did their job. And Tom Troop was chairing the Revenue Committee during part of that time, and he was a very strong advocate for the things that came out of that committee. So when Governor Attia would propose something and it would end up coming out of that committee, I not only was pushing myself as a member of the committee and a caucus leader, but I had Tom Troop, who was very skilled and articulate and very knowledgeable about the revenue items. But I carried a lot of the revenue bills during that time. And when Tom would assign them around, he wanted them to pass. So I got a reputation as somebody who could get a revenue bill passed on the floor, but knowing I would never get Wally Priestley's fault.
Right. Some things are a given.
Yeah, some things are a given. So I would say that it was a pretty clear understanding when, whether it was Governor Tia's bill or a bill that came from someplace else, but mm-hmm. we had a lot of the governor's bills in that period mm-hmm. of time. Mm-hmm. Occasionally they'd be introduced by a member, but they were Vic's bills. Mm-hmm. They were part of a package sometimes that would come in mm-hmm. with several units, but they were the whole concept. I think they looked at it as a package and they needed to get all the components. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they were smaller bills because it was just too much stuff to consider all at once. And you had a better chance of passing one of those small bills mm-hmm. than you did a whole tax implementing. So, yeah.
Clearly a lesson lost on Congress right now.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So you become Secretary of State. Talk about what it was like to be, now you had, in effect, an equal power base with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about what it was like to be there. You know, you got the lands board. You know, there's a variety of things where you're coming together. Talk about what that relationship was like, and, you know, I know that he had weekly meetings with his department heads. Yeah. Did he do that with you? You know, those kinds of things. Yeah.
Well, he usually had two meetings a week, mm-hmm. and half of his heads of his agencies would be at one meeting, like mm-hmm. on Wednesday, and the others would be there on a Thursday, and I did those meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Atiyah invited me right away. As mm-hmm. soon as I became Secretary of State, he invited me to join in those meetings. He didn't have to do that.
Uh-huh.
They were his meetings. They weren't mine. But it gave me an incredible insight into all of the agencies of government. I'd be listening to the Department of Agriculture, and I'd be listening to the veterans, to the National Guard. And I'd mm-hmm. I got a chance to listen for all of that time, for those two whole years. I got mm-hmm. a chance to listen to sort of the guts of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the different kind of leadership among his own people, mm-hmm. among the agency heads. They were very different group of people, very diverse in the sense that they had very different styles and very different kind of management, very different reporting styles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always considered it a privilege that I got that, because when I became governor, I had an asset I would have never had without that.
Yeah.
You could not have gained that just sitting in the state treasurer's office, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or the Secretary of State's office, for that matter. So that was an incredible asset for me. Governor Tia was always so respectful. When I became Secretary of State, I got the respect from him of another statewide official.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite equal. You can't be quite equal mm-hmm. with the governor, but close.
Mm-hmm.
And in my role as Lieutenant Governor, which we're now very aware of in Oregon at this point mm-hmm. in time, it takes a little while to understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Except it didn't take me very long. You know why? Because very shortly after I was sworn in as Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
I got a call from Jerry one night.
Mm-hmm.
Said, can you hold that? I'm going to take this because I'm waiting for a lawyer to call me back.
It's the code.
Yeah. So, let's see. I was
going he was opened. Oh, the succession. So did he call you?
No.
Jerry
called me.
Jerry
called me and said, Madam Secretary, I just wanted to let you know that we just took Governor Atiyah to the hospital. And then there was a second sentence, but there was a break.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, everything's fine, but, well, it was, by then I was, on the floor practically, It scared the hell out of me. It was a really good reminder to get that so early in my term that you really are the Lieutenant Governor and you really need to remember that. So when this recent issue came up with Kate Brown coming home from a National Secretary of State's meeting
mm-hmm.
on the Governor's call, And people said to me, well, why did she just rush home? I said, she's the lieutenant governor. You rush home.
Yeah.
And they said, really? And I said, I would have done the same thing. Yeah. I mean, that's what you do. That's your job.
Yeah.
There, if there's a break in that, there's nobody in office.
Mm-hmm.
And until you're sworn in, there is nobody in that office. And you, if I mean, she didn't know he wasn't going to resign that morning or that night even.
Yeah.
So I tried to explain to people because I've been asked about it so many times. But when Jerry said, they've just taken Governor Attia to the hospital. And I don't know how many days it was after I was sworn in, but it wasn't very long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an eye-opener.
Yeah.
So that's when you get the lieutenant governor part. You really understand that part.
Yeah.
And the other piece is because you're in charge of the elections division, you get all the political stuff that surrounds that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, Governor Attia could have not included me the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, of course, I served on the land board with him then, and we had other activities we did together in that period of time. But he really gave me an incredible asset, you know, by that. And he was in the meetings. When I'm first going to those meetings, of course, you know, this is not a new thing to him. He's already been doing it. And not a new thing to those agency heads. I'm the new kid on the block. And I was kind of quiet for a while, which is unusual for me. But I really wanted to learn. I really wanted to listen. And my role was not to participate anyway unless I had something from my agency that was worthy of bringing to the group. But it was a college education, like a master's degree in government in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was followed by Governor Goldschmidt coming into office and said, I don't do show and tell meetings.
Mm-hmm.
He thought those were show and tell meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You come and report to your governor and everybody gets to show off, you know, what they're doing. Well, there's no quicker way for a governor to learn about an agency than hearing it from that agency head.
Every week.
So, and if something gets past the governor because they haven't reported it, then you know you've got a problem when you know something is going on there and you're not hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, or they don't want to report it in front of all those other agency heads.
Mm-hmm.
So it's way more than show and tell in my estimation. And I missed it terribly when I didn't have it after that. It was a loss for me to lose that contact. The other good thing besides the learning I got out of it was I began to know the agency heads of all of those agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the governor's agency's heads, but I had relationships with them. And they were not deep, I don't think, but they knew who I was. I knew who they were. We could have a conversation about their agency or we could just chit-chat. But Vic gave me that, too. That was another huge thing to learn as I really got to see the management people in state government, who they were, how they worked, how they didn't work, you know, whatever was the good, the bad, and the ugly of that.
Mm-hmm.
And Vic just handed me that, just a gift, and it was incredible.
Did you do that when you were governor? Or a version of that?
A version of that, yeah, but not nearly the depth and breadth that Vic did it. My staff were not supportive of the big meetings, but they did group meetings of all the environmental agencies and that kind of thing, but sometimes without me. They were not, you know, they were not reporting to the governor. They were more reporting to staff, and that reflected my staff more than me. But I always thought they were valuable, and if I had it to do over again, I'd do it. Exactly. I think it was very valuable. And it, you know, and the state treasurer was also there. I mean, and, you know, the attorney general. And so you had all these statewide elected officials who were in one of those two meetings at least every week. And I think it was very valuable. So, and I think it was for everybody, because if you were the head of the Department of Revenue, you could hear what the people were saying over in the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. I thought that was incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
So agency heads got a lot more feel. And when we were doing Measure 5 budgets, when I did the first Measure 5 budgets, we budgeted in with all the, when we tried to put the budget together, we put all of the environmental agencies together, all the agencies that were related to business together. Mm-hmm. And we, what it said, you know, said, okay, you don't want us to cut your agency? Well, tell your colleagues which one of their agencies you'd like to cut. Changes the whole conversation. Yeah. So I think in many respects what Vic was doing did that as well. It, it created a, and because they were cutting budgets then, they were all colleagues, they were all in it together, and they wouldn't have been quite in it so together, I think, without that. I think that made some difference. You didn't hear as much whining. Because everybody was in the same boat, you know, and I think that was wise. So
I talked to Vern Duncan, who came on board, and so he attended the last McCall cabinet meeting. And then Bob Straub was sworn in right after that. But his recollection of dealing with the governors was, with Bob Straub, you would talk to Bob, and sometimes the staff would come through. When you talk to Vic, what Vic said is what the staff did. And when you talk to Neil, you couldn't talk to Neil. It just basically didn't happen. Was that, I mean, with your experience with Vic and Neil?
I mean, because Neil and I were both Democrats, we probably had I had a little bit more access than some people did. But not a lot, not a lot. And there was, I mean, sometimes he would call on me to, you know, in one time he said to me, I've got these two projects I want you to look at, and I want you to chair one of them. One of them was an education reform, which I had a long history with, and the other was the reform of workers' comp. He thought I'd take the education one, and I took the workers' comp one. And we got some stuff done ahead of the Mahonia Hall conference. We actually did some really good work, and we had, it was a quiet little behind the scenes committee, and we had labor and business, and so we had, you know, pretty good balance of, geez, just gonna do that. Well, I guess it's probably just him calling back to tell me what date they picked. March is, both of my sons, my only two children, both of my sons' birthdays are in March. My daughter-in-law's birthday is in March. My granddaughter's birthday is in March. And my younger son and his wife's wedding anniversary is in March. So when March comes and go, you know, it's kind of like Christmas, you know. It's a little crazy. So we're trying to get everybody organized. And when the grandkids grow up and they become adult, they're not always as cooperative as they were when they were little children and wanted gifts, you know.
Exactly.
Well, I don't know. I think I'm going to be in, you know, someplace, you know, Mexico then or something. I don't know. But anyway, so it takes a little more work. But, and there was a huge difference in the way that the CATIA operated and how Neil operated. And sometimes Neil would just pick up the phone and call and say, why don't you come over to my office? I've got somebody I want you to meet. And you never got any preparation for who you were meeting. He never said, I'm going to have so-and-so in the office tomorrow, and this is what so-and-so does, and I'd like you to be aware of who they are. And so it always made you feel sort of ignorant. You walk in, and if you didn't know who the person was, he'd introduce you. And I remember him saying once, now, this is the man who is a new CEO of the biggest Oregon corporation. Do you know who he is? Well, God, it made you just feel like an idiot, you know, Vic would never have done that. He would never have done that.
Yeah.
He would never have tried to make you look uninformed. Mm-hmm. And so that was a real... damn it, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I need staff.
Yeah.
No, I can't tell you how much last week or before the resignation was announced and all of that stuff was happening and the resignation was in the discussion and I was getting, I don't know, I'd come home and there'd be 100 new emails on my email. Both my phones were just ringing. I'd be on one phone, the other phone. And my phone is unlisted and my cell phone, I don't hardly give out. It's like somebody wrote them on bathroom walls.
Yeah.
I couldn't get anything done. And I was trying to get ready. I had two big speeches, and I was doing my first, performing my first ever wedding ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I had my little thing from the online, so I could do that. And I was trying to get the ceremony written, and the damn phone was... I finally went out and stayed all night with my boyfriend one night and just let everything ring. I mean, except my cell phone, because my family gets me there. But so it was really... it was really... I just wished for staff during that time. I really was overwhelmed. Yeah. I couldn't even take the messages down fast enough to... I have lists in there, and I'm still checking them off to make sure that in between the press calls... Some, most of which I did, but lots of which I didn't, were other kind of messages, and they were written in these lists, and I turned the page and started another page, and I'm trying to be sure I didn't miss anything I should have picked up during that time, and I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that Thursday, because all hell broke loose on Wednesday, and then Thursday, we didn't know what was going to happen. I had, in fact, I interviewed Jerry Thompson in Salem. Then I checked my voicemail and email, nothing. I went to lunch a block and a half from the Capitol with a former student, checked, 12:45, got in my car, went to Lake Oswego for a funeral, got home, and my email and my voicemail had exploded.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just whoosh.
It just, it really was. I've never had anything happen like that.
Yeah.
I've never had that kind of phone reaction. Only once while I was governor did I ever have a phone reaction like that. It had to do with the parole board, but and they gave out the number on the phone, and I came into the office, and the poor woman at the front desk was just going crazy.
Yeah.
It was an awful experience because, you know, it was one of those things they do to try to upset the office, and... I'm sure Vic probably had some of those too, but I only remember one that came close to what I had. Mm-hmm. And here I was, poor little person all by myself.
Exactly. You
know, I need help. But
I still have my list as well, because I was just flipping, writing. I was getting three to a page.
Yeah, that's what you've got to do. Amazing. And then I messed up one of the numbers, and it was one of the people I actually wanted to call. So then I had to... say, now, I wonder how I can get this, the other digit that I messed up. And you know, I said, well, I could just call till I got the right one, because there's only, if it's only one digit, then you can just keep calling, you know.
Nine calls, you should get it.
Yeah, but the person called back three more times by the time I got down the list, so it was okay.
Perfect.
So
perfect.
I became close personal friends with Pat Doris.
Uh-huh.
I saw him down at the Capitol later in the day after the... swearing in, and I walked up to him and said, I really miss hearing from you. Because he was calling about four times a day. It was just awful. So, what a mess.
Yep. So, one of the fun things when you mentioned Pat Doris, I do have a small bidding war going between Coin and KGW for me. So.
Oh, this is
That's
good.
Nice.
Let him do that. Let him bid.
You betcha. So, Secretary of State. So, good working relationship. Graduate level introduction to government, but then you want to be an auditor, and Victor doesn't want you to be an auditor. So talk me through that.
Well, the Secretary of State was already state auditor.
Yeah.
That's a constitutional provision. But what we wanted to do was more than just dollar and cent auditing. It was the accountability piece of auditing. You know, the state says you can spend $2 million, then that's an easy audit. Did you spend it or didn't you? Did you spend it all? Did you spend more than you were supposed to spend? That's a fairly easy audit.
Mm-hmm.
What's not an easy audit is to find out if what you're doing is making any difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of auditing was beginning to be the norm around the country in places like Boston and others, mm-hmm. where they had, of course, a lot of Harvard influence there.
Right.
And in places where they had a lot of academic evaluative kind of climates,
mm-hmm.
that was what was happening at the performance auditing. And I had been reading about it, watching it. Norma had talked about it, but mm-hmm. never proceeded with it. Donna Zajon talked about it a little bit during the campaign. I talked about it quite a bit during the campaign, and that wasn't my reason for pushing it. I really got worried that when people think you're auditing, they think you're looking for either crime,
mm-hmm.
waste, or inefficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the word for me was not efficiency, it was effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Is what we're doing making any difference? You're spending the amount the legislature said you could spend, but is it making any difference? That's what performance auditing does
yeah.
for you. It's a great tool for the governor
mm-hmm.
and could have been, I thought, very useful to a governor.
Mm-hmm.
Vic saw it as an intrusion into the executive role.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't move him on it. He just mm-hmm. was so convinced it was a step in his department, and his departments weren't auditing performance.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to offer him a tool as governor, or any other governor, a tool that all over the nation, the experts were saying, this makes sense in government. We always get blamed for not doing a good job, and people use the term efficiency, but what they really are after is effectiveness.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that I cared about. You know, if you've got a children's institution like McLaren,
mm-hmm.
and you're spending millions of dollars to operate that for kids who committed crimes, how's it working? Are those kids coming out of McLaren and they're back in the adult system in 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Are they coming out and going back to school? Are they, you know... We wanted to know, and we thought that a government ought to know that,
mm-hmm.
and an auditor ought to know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the end, I got the performance auditing. Neil agreed with me, and when mm-hmm. he was running, I badgered him about it. And so it was one place he agreed right away. So I had his vote and his support and his endorsement when I started on it the next time. And so that was I think probably the biggest disagreement, public
mm-hmm.
and private, that Vic and I ever had. I knew how he was looking at it, and I could understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I know later on when I became governor that those performance audits being done by the Secretary of State were valuable.
Yeah.
They were very valuable, particularly with a first Measure 5 budget.
Oh, yeah.
I had audits that said, this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not producing what it says it will produce. So those, over that period of time with Measure 5 for that 4 years, I was cutting budgets all the time, and I had this new tool.
Mm-hmm.
It took a while for it to, you know, really develop, because the people who do that kind of auditing are different kind of auditors.
Yeah.
They're not paying.
Very few CPAs.
CPAs. And so we were hiring a new kind of auditor
mm-hmm.
in that process and examining the agencies through a different lens.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no question it was a big change. But we were still doing all the dollar and cent audits.
Mm-hmm.
We just were, and then how we really made it successful for a while, at least until it got to be acceptable, was the legislature chose the first number of performance audits, and mm-hmm. we audited what they wanted.
Yeah.
And they got the tool in the legislature as well.
Right, so they buy into it. And
yeah,
well,
and that was,
go.
Yeah, and for us, we wanted to show that it could work, and, you know, we saved millions of dollars in this just first five or six audits, where mm-hmm. we could show that we had saved it. So, mm-hmm. but that was really hard for me, because Vic just was not going to buy into that. It mm-hmm. didn't matter how I designed it or how I redesigned it, he wasn't going to buy
yeah.
into it, and
yeah.
and I was pretty upset about that, and we talked about it, but I was really irritated.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed so contrary to a good businessman,
mm-hmm.
you know, because performance mm-hmm. audits are a businessman's tool in a company.
Yeah.
And they basically do performance audits as much as they do financial audits. But somehow this just, for him, it was just an intrusion
mm-hmm.
for the Secretary of State into the governor's authority.
Yeah.
And I was never going to get by that. And I understood that. So when Vic's term was over, I knew that I had to, if I wanted it, I had to get Goldschmidt to be there. And I probably, I don't know whether he cared that much. He just said, sure,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. But maybe he thought it was a good idea. I guess he did.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, that was the difference. So, and the other big project I had through Vic's term and then through Neil's was the archives building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because I started that while he was, you know, I made the first legislative request for design money.
Mm-hmm.
And to do the first look at it,
yeah.
serious look at it, and I mean, I can't remember now. I think I went through four regular legislative sessions package here and got that one done, and then we'd move
mm-hmm.
on to the next one, and then
mm-hmm.
we'd get another piece done, and then we'd get the land all straightened
mm-hmm.
out, and it was a very complex project. It when I wrote in it in my autobiography, I partly chose that in such detail to kind of show how much detail there is in a big
mm-hmm.
project like that.
Because, mm-hmm.
you know, you get one piece done, okay, we're going to let you look at the design, Madam Secretary of State, but don't you dare go one inch past that. So now we've got a proposed design, and then
mm-hmm.
we've got to talk about land, and then we have to move the houses that are on there, and then we, you know, every time, you know, then and every committee in the world had to approve it in the legislature, and the city of Salem,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, it really
mm-hmm.
was complex, and so I thought it was kind of a lesson in the workings of government, and it
mm-hmm.
had a successful ending, but you know, then that stupid carpet thing,
I know.
And you know, the thing that was so funny about that, the only reason that ever came up was because the old building where audits, where archives was held, the other half of that was a carpet warehouse.
Hmm.
And the guy who owned the carpet warehouse did not want them to move out of the building.
Right, so he leaked the carpet thing.
And so he showed that he could do cheaper carpet than we... Of course he did cheaper carpet. It was junk, you know. And but that's where it started
yeah.
from, was from there. And,
yeah.
You know, this building came in on time, under budget. You know, it did
mm-hmm.
everything you would want a really important building to do. And we got just... killed on that goddamn carpet.
Yeah.
It was just so frustrating. but I never drive by the building. I don't feel proud of it. I mean, it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, and that was one that Vic could have said to me, you know, I don't know that we need this. I don't know that we can afford this. I mean, he could have stepped up and not
mm-hmm.
been supportive of that, but he didn't,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think partly because as I knew him better over the years, I realized that he liked the history. He liked
yeah.
the history a lot. And
yeah.
his own history is so beautifully on display at Pacific University.
Mm-hmm.
It just represents, I think, his belief in the things he saved tells you he cared about the history.
Yeah.
You know, and some people toss stuff all the time and they don't have any sense of it being historical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those of us who care about history know it's those little things that make the history fun
right.
and exciting and interesting.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like Carrie Chimchuck with his with his things at the Oregon Historical Society, he shows off those things every time there's a public meeting because it's so exciting. It's the little thing that's so exciting.
Absolutely. Let me show you a fun thing here. Oops, I have to spell it correctly. There we go. So this is just one of those fun things. This is the memo from Jerry to the governor about who was with them and who wasn't on the unitary tax. So you read the memo, and as you go down, then he's written in more names.
Oh, God, isn't this wonderful?
So it's just, you know, things like that. She saved or he saved. And, you know, just so valuable.
Oh, yeah, these are terrific. And then he added some Norse senators, huh?
Yeah, and he didn't ever tell her these are with us or not. He just added them and then gave it back to her.
Wow. Said,
your list isn't quite complete.
Well,
he didn't say that. He just did it. But yeah, that kind of stuff is just
funny to see Isaac Regenstrife's name is Ike Regenstrife because nobody ever called Isaac Regenstrife Ike.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of stopped me when I read Pamela McCormick. Hank Crawford, that's a name I haven't thought about for a long time. God, isn't that exciting? Now, why is Yee way down here?
I don't know.
That may be appropriate, but...
Yeah.
God, she was hard to work with.
When I was talking with Hardy, he's not sure that he was actually sworn in as speaker when Victor was inaugurated because they had a kerfuffle in the house.
Yeah, they did.
And so he can't quite remember, and I was remembering... it turned out that there's a 5-day rule. Once you start, if the house isn't formed by 5 days, then, you know, the session is suspended or something.
Yeah,
that was a wonderful tool to get people to vote.
Yeah.
But I was just remembering when Mei Yee held up the organization of the Senate for, you know, like 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. It was...
And it was... For what? But that was Mei.
She always... There, you know, there used to be these Yee-isms that mm-hmm. got told around the mm-hmm. Capitol building, you know, things that she'd said that mm-hmm. when she didn't understand something and she mm-hmm. spoke out in a committee. And the one I always remember the most was the one about the school buses. Do you know that mm-hmm. one? Mm-hmm. There was a piece of legislation that would require that every school bus had a backup. Mm-hmm. Signal, so when it was backing up, it made noise. And she reported that she was going to vote against that stupid bill because all you had to do when you were backing up was back up and just honk your horn all while you were backing up. And we were thinking, oh my God, 12 school children run over by bus driver, you know. I mean, but she never wanted to spend money on anything like that.
Yeah.
And the other one was the big argument she got in a committee one day with a agency head who was reporting how much something was going to cost. And he said, you know, the estimate on this is it's going to be $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the testimony went on and more questions were asked, and maybe you went back to him and said... Now, the cost on this again is, and he said, it's $500,000. And she said, make up your mind. See, you called it $500,000, and now you're telling us $500,000. And what do you do?
There you go.
So there used to be a whole series of those. And because she'd served in both the House and Senate, we got, mm-hmm. The stories, if anybody had ever printed them, they would have been a really... amazing set of, but my final contact with her when, after Frank died and he still had an office mm-hmm. because we hadn't cleaned it out mm-hmm. yet. We were ready to clean it out, you know, after he was out of the Senate and Mei Yee was going to get the office, and mm-hmm. she got so anxious to get in there, she started moving Frank's stuff out. She got mm-hmm. staff in there, and they're boxing Frank's office. Oh, my Christ, I almost went through the ceiling. Mm-hmm. You know, she's in my husband's office, who just died, and she's over there getting her staff. She wasn't boxing, yeah. of course. Getting her staff to box all his stuff, to clean his files out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was furious. I was still home. I took 5 or 6 days off mm-hmm. after Frank's services before I came back to the Capitol. And by the time I came back, she was almost done cleaning out his office. And I found it out when she was partway done. I was just devastated.
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if yeah. things got thrown away. I don't know. Yeah. You know, I think they did.
Yeah.
And it was very upsetting. So, you know, that was my last encounter with her. And that left a very bad taste in yeah. my mouth. But, man. You know, that's not many people. I don't think anybody else in that building would have done that.
No.
I don't think there's yeah. another person of either party who would have done yeah. that. It was just,
she's just on her own planet.
Yep, that's the case. So.
So, talk to me. I mean, he leaves office in January of 87. Any encounters with him, you know, around the coffee shop he might pop in or something?
I don't remember, other than, you know, I always knew when we showed up for a new governor to be sworn in, or for a new
right.
session to start,
right.
or
there.
For the state's birthday, I always knew he'd be there.
Yeah.
There was never any question, well, is Vic Atiyah coming? Of course he's coming. I mean,
yeah.
he always was there for those things. So when they did Christmas holidays in the Capitol, he was there. I mean, so it was just not unexpected to run into him. And even after I went away, after I left the governor's office and went back east for those 4.5 years and mm-hmm. came back, I mean, the first things I started doing were going to those things
yeah.
that I missed, like state birthdays and things mm-hmm. like that. And so, and Ted Kulongoski started the Governor's Gold Award. So
mm-hmm.
then every year, I knew also that Vic would be there, that mm-hmm. that other thing that was so special between the governors. And so it seemed like, as time went on, when Neil Goldschmidt was no longer in public
mm-hmm.
as a former governor, and Don Kitzhaber, between his second and third term, when he had that mm-hmm. 8 years off, he wasn't much in evidence, mm-hmm. and Ted Kulongoski was busy being governor. It was often just Vic and me,
mm-hmm.
and we kidded about, you know, we'd show up any place, you know, for the opening of a, you know, an envelope, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we laughed about it sometime, but, you know, we'd be at Camp Rosenbaum, and we'd be at some veterans parade, and we'd be at some tribal thing, Vic more than me. He
mm-hmm.
certainly had a longer history there than I did. And then the Governor's Gold Awards started, and we were, of course, always there, and we were at the state's birthday. And it seemed like we were just at so many things, and often it was just the two of us,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then once Ted left office, then Ted was
mm-hmm.
more attentive, like the two of us were. And so we had that wonderful opportunity to spend time with Vic at Camp Rosenbaum and places like that. And it was one of my fondest memories, and you probably won't want to quote this, but you have to be sensitive about
mm-hmm.
these things sometimes, but the Cortland Rose Festival Association
mm-hmm.
Sold an auction item where Governor Tia, Governor Kulongoski, and I were sold at auction.
Mm-hmm.
And the event took place in at the Allison Hotel in Newburgh when they actually did it. Mm-hmm. And it was a series of tables. Actually, it was three big tables, and the people who bought seats at them, Vic and Ted and I would change tables.
Yeah.
So we were all coming to the Allison Hotel, and it was a cold, dark, windy, nasty night, one of those awful nights. I hated driving out there. Mm-hmm. I was driving out by myself, and it was cold and dark, and I didn't know exactly where I was supposed to park and all mm-hmm. that. I remember walking into the hotel and looking down toward the other side of the lobby where the fireplace was, and there was Governor Tia and several other people, most of whom I knew, but not mm-hmm. all, and they were standing there chatting in front of the fireplace, and Vic looked up, and there's kind of that long hall that runs right into the lobby area, and Vic looked up and saw me coming, and he stopped. He just walked away from these guys he was talking to, just walked away from them, and started walking toward me. And it was right after Christmas, so it must have mm-hmm. been January. And I had just sent out my my holiday newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in print, I had talked about Don Nelson, the man who is my mm-hmm. very special friend now. And I'd use the word, you know, mm-hmm. about falling in love. And Vic got mm-hmm. the letter like he always got my letters. And he came up and he put his arms around me and he said, "Oh, Barbara, I'm so sad. I thought I still had a chance." And, you know, I couldn't tell it because for Dolores it wouldn't have been appropriate for me to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would not have said anything
right.
that is
right.
would even hint at anything that would do that. But
mm-hmm.
it just tickled me so much. He said, "Oh, Governor, I got your Christmas newsletter. I'm so sad. I thought I still had a chance." And I came home and I told Don that, and I told one of my sons that. It was just so warm and sweet
yeah.
and cute. But it was just, you know, there's some of those moments that happen that, you know, that are so personal, and after you've been around someone that many years,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we're still former governors, and we behave like former governors, mm-hmm. hopefully. But I can remember a number of times. I remember his coming up to me at Oregon Public Broadcasting. We were both walking into the studios one afternoon for something. And it was right after the story about Neil Goldschmidt
mm-hmm.
and the scandal broke there.
Yeah.
And he said, "Governor, I'm so sorry." I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was the assumption that I would be really sad, you know, and of course, you were so stunned you didn't know whether you were sad or what, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. But just the fact that he understood that might be upsetting to me.
Yeah.
And then we had a little discussion about it after that, but, you know, every time there's one of those points in time where you could sort of ignore it and not be personal.
Mm-hmm.
Vic never did that. He always mm-hmm. Took the you know, the personal side seriously,
mm-hmm.
and that was really nice. But that night, I thought about it so many times that it always makes me laugh. And I wanted to tell it at the service, but I just knew I couldn't do
yeah.
that. I knew that wasn't appropriate. His
yeah.
family was there, and it was not the kind of thing you can tell because it might be misunderstood. And
right.
So it was done in great humor, but it was just, you know, and he would do that with me. I mean, we'd go over, I have something of Vic's, but you can't have it, but I'll show it to you.
Okay.
I probably should let you have it, but...
Well, you know where we are.
I know, but I want you to see it, because I have to use it for a little bit longer before I actually... hanging in my kitchen. This is Vic's.
Oh, yeah.
And look at the back.
Wonderful.
And it was given to me at the last... at the last Camp Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
And they said... "We think you should have this for a while." The Rosenbaum family gave
yeah.
it to me. He said,
we think you should have this for a while. And so I'd like to wear it a couple more times to Ken Rosenbaum, but then I'll probably just turn it over to the archives.
Yeah, you know where we are.
Yeah. But isn't that great?
That's wonderful.
And I don't know whether he made this one himself or not. You never know, but he sure signed it.
Yeah. That's fabulous.
Isn't that great?
Fabulous.
Yeah.
So one last question.
Yeah.
The ex-governor's club. Is it the shared experience of being a governor that turns into friendship? Is it you guys just get along together and, you know, have to go to the same events, and so you build a relationship? I mean, people talk about this, you know, with the presidents too.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
The way Clinton and Bush too have bonded. You know what?
Well, you know, of each of the governors, that there's just less than a handful of people that you know who've had that experience in your state. So it is a very limited group in number. And I don't think you can, regardless of political affiliation or experience of any other kind about being a governor, there's no way you can look at another governor and not know what they've been through.
Mm-hmm.
Not know how hard it is, how pressured it is, how much you give up, how many demands there are on your life, how much your family gets neglected. You know all that because you've been there. So nobody else can quite, I think, have the respect that you have for another governor because nobody else knows what it's like. I mean, I think that's it as much as anything. There is a bond that comes from that understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter how many years go by. Bob Straub, I can remember, even when he was quite a bit older and not in good health and his Alzheimer's was there. I can remember... I have a picture of Neil and Straub and me and my parents that was taken at a fundraiser when I was running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always loved the photograph because, you know, at the time you didn't get many photographs with three governors in them. And then I have Associated Oregon Industries. I'm sure you've come across the picture of the boys and me.
Right. Yeah.
We always referred to that as the boys and me. But, you know, there weren't many of those pictures, and there weren't many times we had that many governors.
Mm-hmm.
And the pictures were always important to me because they felt so unique and special and historical. And I have a bunch of stacks in there right now of newspapers that I'm going to clip pictures out of Tate Brown and me that were taken over the last few days. And it's a lot. It's a lot of photographs, and I'm sure I don't have them all, but I have a lot. Mm-hmm. And I know they're historical photographs, and someday somebody's going to want them.
Yeah.
And even though they're news clips, they can go back and find originals. They'll know where to find them.
Yeah.
And writing this book now, you know, you get to pay for a lot of photographs. But
we're having an interesting conversation with the Oregonian right now.
Really?
They're selling theirs.
Oh, all of them?
All of them. A million prints. They probably already have sold them, but they kept the rights. It's so we first found out because Denny Miles was just trolling around a few weeks ago and found a bunch of them on eBay. And you sell them to a company, the company then digitizes them, you keep the rights, but the prints themselves, the company then sells to make back its money and make a profit.
I did not know they were doing that.
Yeah. So they have a funny quote from Don Hamilton, who used to be a reporter there. His photo was on sale for like $22.95. He said, who on earth would pay $22.95?
For my photograph?
Yeah. But there's a ton of them. We just looked at the Vic ones, and you just go to eBay and put them in, and there's just all sorts of them. So I contacted the Oregonian. We're trying to figure out what the deal is, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's amazing.
Wow. Well, you know, I paid for Oregonian photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I paid for Associated Press photographs, and
mm-hmm.
they're a little bit more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them were so cheap that all I had to do was tell them I'd send them a free book, and the photographer would let me off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
The Advocate, the African American paper, they'd give me any picture I'd print.
Mm-hmm.
They were happy to have it as long as I gave them credit.
Yeah.
And, well, the other person who has photographs, of course, you must know is Jerry Lewin. And
yeah,
said,
yeah.
God, if his house ever burns down, history goes down the drain.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
It scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I went in there and I looked at dozens and dozens and dozens of photographs when I was doing my book, and I just, there they are in that house.
Yeah.
Sort of unprotected.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
It's so scary.
Pretty
no,
amazing.
So, okay, yeah, that's interesting. Well, and I may have some photographs of Vic, and if I can come across them, I'll let you have them.
Okay, great, thanks.
I'll look and see what I've got, because sometimes we get these casual photographs taken
mm-hmm.
on somebody's camera, you know, family
yeah.
member or,
yeah.
you know, at some event. And
yeah, yep, absolutely. Do you have contact information for Governor Kulongoski?
I do.
Would you be willing to share it? He's a little squirrely.
Yeah. Let me see.
Even touch base with him
nope.
and see if it's okay. Because he's... I got to talk to him.
Okay.
I mean, I just have to talk
oh,
to
yeah,
him.
Oh, yeah, you do. Would you be satisfied if it was an address and then you could
yeah,
send
yeah,
him a
send
letter?
Yeah, send a letter. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I hate to give phone numbers.
Yeah, no, that's...
Then
that's
they'll start to know where they come from.
yeah, exactly.
But the address doesn't seem...
Yeah.
An old-fashioned address book, can you imagine that?
Yes, it's amazing.
Oh, I love them. Address.
4232
Northeast Cooch Street. C-O-U-C-H.
Yep, Northeast Cooch. Uh-huh.
Portland 97213.
13. Good.
Yeah,
good.
That'll get you there.
Yeah.
You know, the house that they bought after they left the governorship, the house they bought used to be owned by Mel Gordon, County Commissioner Mel
uh-huh.
Gordon. Yeah.
Huh?
And I said, are there Republican vibes left in here?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, Don.